Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here on Alaska Day 2015, middle of October, and definitely been seeing some October-like weather. The first opening of the month, we had those I guess 4 or 5 days of some sunny, warm weather, which was a pleasant break from the wet conditions we'd had previously. But since that time, we've seen a series of low pressures moving through. Some with, I guess, one of them was remnants of a hurricane, which was forecast to be quite windy. Although that wind seemed to have missed us, we did get some other wind events with rain as well, and even some thunder and lightning, which was kind of fun to observe. Although I didn't get to see the lightning flashes myself, I did hear some rolls of thunder, which is not too common around here, it seems like. It's certainly been a while. I guess I heard some in the spring, but I hadn't heard any in several months at least. One thing that's come in with the stormy weather has been the storm petrels. I've enjoyed watching them. For some reason, they seem to come in this time of year, October. They're abundant on St. Louis area nesting, but they mostly go out offshore to feed, both leeches and fork-tailed storm petrels. For some reason, it's the fork-tailed storm petrels that we mostly see that come in with this stormy weather, and they're in close to shore. Except at night sometimes, I did see my first leeches storm petrel that was alive and not captured flying through the lights at Muller Park when I was there the other evening. Just one came through and flew over the field several times and could see it very clearly under the light. I'm not sure where they're going during the day, but it's pretty unusual for somebody to see one, whereas the fork-tailed storm petrels are quite common in the water. And so it's a good opportunity to visit those or visit the waterfront and see those here in Sitka. If you don't look soon, though, the chances are if the weather turns nice and stays nice for a while, they'll disappear pretty quick. And regardless, they seem to disappear by early November at the latest. So kind of a short window there. So as these came in this week, I was grateful to get reports of them from folks sending emails. You can send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or if you're interested in birds specifically, you can sign up for the Sitka Birds email list by going to sitkanature.org. You can also find the Sitka Birds Facebook group just by searching for Sitka Birds on Facebook. As well, if you are interested in recordings of past shows, you can go to sitkanature.org/raven and find links to recordings of most of my past shows there. You can also go to Sitka Nature or search for the Sitka Nature page on Facebook, and I will be posting updates when I get those shows uploaded as we go forward. I'd like to go ahead and introduce the conversation I have recorded for this week's show. I was able to speak with Ashley Bulwark, who is the new aquarium manager at the Sitka Sound Science Center. Previously, she had been the education specialist there, and with Taylor White's departure for graduate school this fall, Ashley has stepped into that role. But I was curious about some of the education programs that Ashley's been a part of, and so we'll join the conversation with her speaking a little bit about that transition and what's going on with those programs at the Science Center now.
So we're actually in the process of hiring somebody new to do most of our education programming. But we have kind of three set programs that we're going to continue for sure. Those being, we have a preschool program once a week where 3 to 5 year olds come with their parents and get to explore science topics. And there's usually a story and some arts and crafts and things like that. We have an every other weekend Saturday program for families that are members at the Science Center, where they can come, again, kind of exploration based, where there will be a different topic every other week when we have it. And then they get to kind of go to different stations and do their inquiry-based learning. And then we have an after-school program that we work on with the GLOW program over at Keat. So we're also going to continue doing that. So those are the three that we're definitely going to maintain, kind of more on the education side of things. In the aquarium, we have a docent program, which was a huge hit this last year. And the idea behind the docent program is that in the spring, we run, it's usually 10 to 12 weeks long, where folks come in for an hour and a half every Wednesday. And they learn about the aquarium and the cool things going on at the Science Center, with the idea that they want to volunteer their time as interpreters at the Science Center. And so we had a great group of docents this last year who signed up for a ton of hours, and they come to the Science Center and help out at the front desk and help you know, chat with visitors all summer and in the winter. They do tank feeding, which we do at 2 o'clock, and they get to chat with everybody who's there and explain what's going on. And my latest is that many of them are interested in helping clean the tanks, which is remarkable to me that everybody's like, I want to come and clean tanks with you. So we'll see how that goes. But we're going to try to continue that again this year. We'll do a new class of docents again this spring.
And so is the docents age range tend to be like middle school, high school?
These are actually adults.
Or adults.
For docents, okay. Yeah. And so we've had a couple of students come with their parents or kind of tag along after the adult finishes the docent training. But for the most part, it's all adults.
Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking there was a couple of, recent graduates, or at least one recent graduate last summer who I'd see there. Trevor was working there. But in any case, so yeah, I remember the cleaning days. That was work study student when SJ in the old days, I guess I should say, when SJ was running it, work study students, and one guy was small enough that he would actually get into the big tank.
Oh, wow.
And with his dry suit, and he would clean it
from
inside.
In there.
Yeah.
We haven't been brave enough to do that the last few years. I think everyone's slightly afraid of the wolf eel. She's very docile and pretty nice, but you just never know. They have those really big, powerful jaws, and so I think everyone's just a little intimidated
that. They could put the bite on you.
Yeah, definitely. But we do still have summer hires that are those high school kids that you're talking about. So, when they're not in school, we hire those folks to come and give tours all summer. And really, when the visitor population is high, we have a lot more folks that can work at the Science Center.
So. Yeah, you know, that makes sense. So, you know, program-wise, I guess, it sounds like most of programs you have are young children, more age, and so I'm just like your experience with those. What sort of things happened? Like, I mean, kids are they're all different. Some of them have a lot of, shall we say, unbounded energy.
Definitely.
And sometimes it can be difficult to direct that energy in a productive way. But other times, like, it leads you into these great new things that you never would even necessarily thought of. You're like, mm-hmm. Oh, wow, there's an opportunity there. So
yeah.
I'm just, like, curious if you have sort of some fun stories from that kind of those experiences.
So many stories on both ends of that. I think my favorite way to go about hanging out with little kids, especially in the intertidal zones, one of my favorite, is to encourage them to explore and discover new things mm-hmm. and think about them in a different way than they're used to, but also trying to make the connection that we are visitors there and therefore need to really take care of mm-hmm. the critters that live there. And so that's always my top priority. It's like my worst nightmare to take 20 kids in the intertidal and they all flip over rocks and scrunch critters and throw things in different places. And so that's something I always try to emphasize ahead of time. But I'm always amazed by the things that they're able to find. And inevitably, you have at least a couple kids in every group who are so excited about what they see. And they will find things that I couldn't have found in a million years. And they'll be like, what is this little pink dot right here? And you totally missed it. And they're like so curious about it. And so those are my favorite times is when they pick things out that you would have totally walked right by.
Yeah, that was my experience with my daughter, especially. For whatever reason, she was far more attuned to the subtler things, shall we say, the tiny things, really. I mean, like, she has come to me, not as much in recent years, but every once in a while still, and she's like, what is this? And I'm like, your hand?
Yeah.
No, right there, this little tiny thrips, mm-hmm. as it turned out. You know, it's like something that's only a couple of millimeters long and then even skinnier than that. And she somehow found it and caught it and was like, it was interested to know. I was like, well, that's something I never would have noticed. That's what that is. But, you know, and then try and take pictures of it. And so it's been helpful for my learning journey to have younger, sharper eyes maybe is part of what it is in part. But, so I imagine with the kids when you're out there that think that happens. I mean, that's probably – so – I'm guessing that you don't always know what it is that they found, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of times I don't know what they've found. And that is a lot of fun to just have the discussion of, well, we don't know what this is, but these are some things that we do know about it. Like, look at where it lives and some of its mouth parts and its body parts. And you can tell a lot about their story as far as mm-hmm. how they live their life based on where you found them and just generally how they look. So that's usually the conversations I try to have with them so they understand that although they might not know the name of everything, they can know a lot about the critter just by looking at it and really thinking through it rather than just, oh, look, something cool. Okay, now let's go find something different.
Yeah, yeah. So what, like, one of the things that's interesting, I mean, I grew up here, and I mean, down at the beach, Sage Beach, when I was a kid, we lived nearby. And so when I was, up until I was probably 10 or 11, that was one of the places I went to play from time to time. And, but, you know, we had Sea Week or whatever in school, and I didn't spend a huge amount of time, like, trying to learn anything, really. I just was playing. And so it's been interesting to me to sort of think back as I've become far more interested and maybe even obsessed about learning names and what everything is, to think back, was I aware of this? Like, do I have any conscious sort of awareness or memories of this from when I was a kid? Because it was certainly there. Mm-hmm. Like, popweed, that fucus was there, and I recognize that, and I remember that. Like, it was so common that I don't remember not knowing that. It was just what was there. Yeah. But one in particular I remember are the little, I think they're Halesakian, I can't remember, but the little seaweeds that have little micro holes in them. So when you squeeze mm-hmm. them, they squirt.
Yeah.
And I suspect that most kids discover, like, as soon as one discovers it, right, then they all yep. know about it.
Exactly. And then it's a matter of trying to explain, why do we not want to squirt everybody else
right.
with the seaweed? But yeah, they inevitably find it.
So are there other sort of things like that that just seem closer to universal in terms of, like, all the kids pretty, you can pretty much guarantee that most kids will engage, at least for that little bit?
Oh, the little tide pool fish are the biggest yeah. hit ever. They love the tide pool sculpins, and especially when they can find the gunnels. They, of course, call them eels,
right.
but that's the best. Especially you flip over a rock, and the eels are wiggling all over, and they just go nuts. I mean, oftentimes they're screaming and squealing, and everybody's excited, and inevitably, you know, 100 times in one walk, someone will walk up to me and be like, look at this eel, look at it wiggle. And that's what everybody's always in love with. Or I've also seen kids sit at a giant tide pool for 10 minutes and try to catch tide pool sculpins.
Yeah.
And they're just, like, enthralled, even though myself, I'm much more interested in invertebrates. So I'm always like, but look at this limpet is right here. And there's so many cool colors and patterns. And they're just totally oblivious.
Yeah.
So excited about the sculpins.
Well, they're trying to catch them with their bare hands.
Yeah.
Which is challenging.
Yeah.
But kids manage it in some cases anyway.
Yeah.
Like my kids did the same thing. Like, we go down to the beach and they would just sit there, like, squatted. Like, you couldn't get them to sit still for 5 minutes anywhere
yeah.
else, but they would sit there for a half an hour just, like,
yeah.
ready to, you know, watching them go and trying to catch. And
mm-hmm.
and it is fascinating how, like, I mean, I guess there's just some innate sort of, like, there's value in being able to catch things.
And it's just amazing how nature can be so captivating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like you said, many of these kids, you can't get to sit still anywhere else. And yet they just, on their own, are captivated by these things in nature. It's really
yeah.
remarkable.
So are you mostly with these, you mentioned, so part of this, I imagine, was, I know that you've done some summer programs as well,
mm-hmm.
like more intensive, I suppose. They were kind of week-long or a couple week-long programs.
Yeah.
And are most of these end up being sort of oriented around the intertidal marine ecosystems?
So not as much in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
The last few summers, we've run several summer camps that are about a week long for different age groups. But we try to make it a variety of topics that we cover. And so the last, I guess 2 years ago, we did a marine science focus camp for
mm-hmm.
kind of the middle elementary school ages. But we do everything. I mean, this year, we did ooey gooey camp and, like, water everywhere camp for younger kids. So just looking at some of the other sides of science. And that's one of the things, although I love the intertidal zone, at the Science Center, we really try to branch out and do a lot of things. And most people know us for our marine resources
mm-hmm.
that we have, because we have the big, beautiful aquariums to come look at, and we have the hatchery and things like that. But we really try to branch out and do a few different things too. So we've done, you know, terrestrial ecology-based camps, and we've done I did a flight camp several years ago. So just lots of different
yeah.
options there.
And so what's the best way for people who might be interested in getting their kids involved or being involved themselves? Like, what's the best way for them to sort of be in touch or keep track
mm-hmm.
of this?
So the Science Center has a website, and
mm-hmm.
we also have a Facebook page. And so the Science Center website is sickascience.org. And all of our stuff goes up on there, and you can look up our ed programs there. The three that I mentioned earlier are regular running programs, Tuesday, at 10:30 is our preschool program, and that's just every week people can drop by. If you become a member at the Science Center, you'll get emails about all of our programs that are coming up. And so we have kind of family memberships, which includes visiting the aquarium whenever you want throughout the year. So that's another great way to do it as well. But generally, we try to put out the information in the newspaper and the radio as well when we have new things coming up.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess, you know, when we were talking about intertidal stuff, I was reminded, I think you're the one that got my brother snorkeling. And a couple years ago when he was here, well, it's been 3 years ago now, I guess, when he was here for the summer doing some wilderness survey stuff, that I remember him, like, that was one of the things we ended up talking a while about, was like his experience snorkeling. Because like me, he grew up here. And
yeah,
like, we're used to going to the beach. And of course, everything's out of the water when the tide's out. And it's kind of all like the seaweed's plastered over everything. And he said, I guess maybe you guys went to John Brown's beach. And he said, like, it was one of the most astounding things, because he got in the water, having never done this before. And like, it was this completely, I mean, like, I'm sure that parts of it were familiar, like, you recognize the stuff. But in the water, like, it was alive in a way that it isn't out of the water.
It's a totally different
and
world.
And it's a different, and it's, and the spatial element, I mean, it just is plastered there on the rocks. Whereas when you're in the water, you have this depth, like, this third dimension that really comes out. And he said it was, I don't know, it was surprising, I guess, maybe is the way to put it. That he felt like he was in this huge space, and then he bumped his knee on the bottom, sort of thing. Like, it was like he could stand up and he wasn't even in waist deep water, but it felt huge. And so it was, it was just really interesting to me to hear him. I'm like, I still haven't gone snorkeling, like, one of these days, right? But that's like, so is that one of the things that you get a chance to do now? I suppose as the aquarium person, you have. You know, official reasons to go snorkeling.
I do, yeah. Snorkeling is one of my favorite things in all the world to do. And I was just astounded that your brother had grown up here and never been snorkeling before. And when we got out of the water, that's the other thing, is when you're in the water, you obviously aren't talking to each other,
because
you have a snorkel in your mouth. And so you're pointing at things and trying to mime and, you know, getting excited. And that was one of the best things when we got out of the water, and he was just like, oh my goodness, like, I can't believe all of that is down there. I had no idea what it looked like underwater. And so there were just millions of questions, and that of course gets everybody excited. But yeah, I get to do more snorkeling specifically for work now. And one of my new favorite things is actually I'm trying to take kids snorkeling again. And really, the way we did that this last year is we had, we called it the Oceans to Alpine Adventure Camp, is what we ran for middle school students this year. So we took them to the pool and got them some snorkel skills. And then the following week, we went on a big snorkel expedition. We did a lot of other fun outdoor skills as well during the 2 weeks. But that was one of the great times to just take the kids in the water and get them out to see these things. I think, sadly, a lot of people haven't been in the ocean snorkeling, and to me, it's a great way to encourage them to recognize that beauty and then to feel like they need to take care of it and to really foster a love for our healthy ecosystems.
Yeah, the snorkeling, you know, I think, I don't know, maybe more people don't snorkel now than when I was a kid, but I suspect probably more people do. Maybe just because the accessibility of the gear is easier. I don't know if it's cheaper exactly, but Amazon, you know, or the internet, you know, where you can just buy stuff if you want. But so the bar to entry, essentially, I mean, it's cold enough here. You want at least a wetsuit, I would imagine.
Yeah, usually
with a hood.
You want a hood and gloves and boots, because otherwise, of course, your extremities get cold the fastest. So those are pretty crucial when you hop in the water. And it really depends on the time of year. Like in the summertime, with that kind of gear and just a really thin basic wetsuit, you can go, you know, for half an hour to 2 hours sometimes before you get really cold. And in the wintertime, it's much shorter. There was one year where I snorkeled every single month until February. We hopped in the water in February, and it was the first time I went, oh man, I might need to get out of the water right now because I'm so frozen. But yeah, it definitely tapers off in the spring where it's pretty cold and takes a while to warm back up again.
So, and I suppose, you know, it's nice to be able to see. Visibility varies throughout the year,
I imagine. It does. Yeah. So, of course, in the spring when we get those giant plankton blooms, you can hardly see anything. The water gets really cloudy because there's so much plankton in the water you can't see through it. And so that's not the most ideal time to go snorkeling because you're basically bumping into things a foot or two in front of you. It's not the best. In the winter, it's the best visibility because we have far less plankton at that point. But of course, then it's colder. So it's this kind of give and take of you can spend more time in the water in the summer, but the visibility is not as great.
Yeah. So, is there what opportunities are there, or are there any? I guess for people, is it just best to find somebody who snorkels and say, "Hey, I want to learn about this"? And I imagine some places are better to practice. Maybe the outer coast is less optimal. Fortunately, right. The road system is all fairly protected, so you can start somewhere.
Yeah. So, sadly, in Sitka right now, the only way to go snorkeling is to find somebody who you know who does it and ask them to take you along. A lot of people have extra sets of gear for that reason. You know, it's snorkeling is ideal to do with more than one person. And so that's really fun. But since the dive shop closed, there's not really a commercial option for going to rent that stuff that I know of. Maybe there are some small, like, mom and pop rent out of their home type things. But yeah, that's the first step, is like find someone who has gear. And then I actually like Magic Island a lot because I feel like it's pretty enclosed and safe to go there. You always know where the beach is, and it's pretty easy to get out. There's not a lot of surge usually. That's what you want to look for, is something where there's not a lot of surge, there's not a lot of boat traffic, and you feel fairly comfortable with the area getting in and out.
So, is it helpful to have less kelp?
It is. So especially for your first dive or snorkel, it's really nice to not have a whole bunch of macrocystis you have to worry about climbing through and swimming around and all of those things. But that's, again, where Magic Island can be great, because they have sort of that eelgrass bed off to the right there. Mm-hmm. You can get in there and just kind of swim over towards the kelp and still get to see some great things without actually going in to the kelp itself.
Yeah, it seems like fun, and it's one of those things that's sort of on my list. I actually have a wetsuit, but I need to get a hood and an actual snorkel. But I figured even just swimming, you know, you can get a little bit of it with some goggles. But
yeah.
I suppose it's nice to be able to keep your face in the water.
It is. Then you're not coming up and losing track of the cool thing you were just looking at.
Yeah.
Because I like invertebrates so much, I'm a very slow snorkeler, and I just kind of spend a large amount of time staring at little tiny things. And so it's in contrast to some people who really just go for the fish. And so they cover a lot of ground and are moving a lot faster and just more excited about those kind of flashy things that are swimming by. So
how do the animals react to you when you're in the water? Like, I mean, obviously most of the invertebrates probably are just like, whatever.
Yeah.
So when fish are they curious? Do they seem curious at times, or?
Some of them are. Some of the schooling fish, like perch, or if you get into some sand lance and things like that, if you're still enough, they'll come over and kind of engulf you in their school, and it can be really cool to sort of interact with them. Many of the sculpin and rockfish are very still animals, and they just sit there and assume that you don't notice them. And then oftentimes you have to actually bump into them before they'll move and get out of the way, which can be nice for collecting in the aquarium, but they also are extremely speedy once you do scare them. So it's a little tricky there. And then things like greenling and that sort are swimming through a lot of times and definitely dart off as soon as they see you. So it really just kind of depends on what the organism is.
So I guess what occurs to me that would be sort of fascinating, and maybe, or interesting in any case, is that when, like, so it, you know, we have good field guides. I mean, that's that compared to the old days, I guess, with color photography and the ability to take pictures digitally and then print them. And so there's some really amazing field guides out there for a lot of these things, which is sort of satisfying in that now it's easier to put a name to a lot of this stuff without becoming a fisheries expert, for example.
Right.
But it seems like, you know, when you're just looking through the field guide, that's this two-dimensional, you know, very static image, but actually seeing them out there in their environment, you know, and how they move, that, like with birds, you know, it's the same sort of thing, except birds are a little more accessible for us just in general, also being air breathers. but you learn, like, you start to see that, oh, behavior and the way that they interact with their environment is very different from species to species. And so, like, I mean, obviously, it, as I say this, it feels really super obvious, but it's also one of those things that because I don't breathe water, you know, or am not able to function underwater effectively, mm-hmm. It didn't occur to me before that probably the fish are exactly the same way. And then, like, there's this whole swath of behaviors and invertebrates as well, mm-hmm. you know, the different shrimps or whatever.
Exactly. And to be able to see them interacting with each other in their ecosystem, but then also the environment. The great thing is that the ocean is always moving, and so mm-hmm. they'll, like, it's the same on land where wind is moving. They live in that environment that in many places there's surge and currents and tide, and, you know, then you're adding an added element of when you swim by, you make your own currents and waves. And so it's really interesting to watch how each critter sort of deals with those things and has made a livelihood there in that area. I will say one other thing about guides is that as an educator as well, I find that for intertidal guides, my favorite is actually black and white line drawings.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason for that is that I find that lots of kids, when they flip open the guidebook, see that one 2D picture and they look at the colors or the shape, and, you know, it gets confusing because many of the critters, of course, just like everything, has a variation of colors
yeah.
and shapes. And so often, especially for students, it's misleading for them to look at the pictures. And so I like the color black and white drawings because then they often have to read the description to think about, okay, well, how large was this thing? Like, what were the shapes of it? How, you know, how can the colors be different? And
yeah,
so that's actually my favorite way to go is but it's hard when you're in the ocean because you see so many great things that you like
yeah.
and you can't take the book with you. And so you have to remember all of those little details before you get back to shore and can flip open and say, okay, I saw this nudibranch and it was white, but I can't remember what the shape of its serrata were or if it was this long or that long. And so it's just really hard to remember all of those little details and identify things. And I think that's what oftentimes brings me back to the ocean always, is that mystery. Like, although
yeah.
you see the things, it's a new mystery every time because you didn't quite get the right details to
yeah.
look it up and figure it out. And
do you try and take picture? Do you, like, I mean, that's the other nice thing these days is that underwater cameras,
mm-hmm.
I mean, relatively inexpensive.
Yes.
I don't know how easy it is to take pictures when you're snorkeling in practice with gloves on. But,
right. It's tricky. I don't currently have an underwater camera, and I have done it in the past.
Yeah.
And I think there are times where I choose to go and take photos, and then there are other times where I choose to just enjoy kind of the whole experience of what's
mm-hmm.
going on. And so it really depends on my goal for the snorkel dive at that point.
Yeah.
Like, do I want to identify some new things at this point? Am I just going collecting? Because if I'm collecting, of course I can't have the camera and
right.
all the goodie bags and things like that. So it gets a little tricky to figure out what your goal is. And again, it's a slow learning process because you only hop in for
right.
half an hour, an hour at a time here
it's
and there.
A little harder to sit and observe for, you know, an extended period of time. Yeah, I, you know, the camera is always, it's an interesting thing. Like, for me, it's been a huge factor in me learning. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's just how I've approached things. And I know other people have felt, and actually it's been a huge factor in me paying better attention.
Yeah.
Because with the camera, I want to take pictures of stuff, so I end up paying more attention. In some ways, in a sort of twisted way, if I don't have my camera, I'm almost afraid to see something that I would want to take a picture
mm-hmm.
of. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
And I get annoyed at myself for not having it. But I know other people, it's like, well, the camera feels like a barrier to their sort of connection with you know, their experience. And that they focus on, you know, they focus on something different than actually just being there and being present. And so, I mean, it's an interesting, and I'm sure, you know, everybody's experience and approach is a little different.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just know for me that like, I want to know what things are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things I don't take pictures of. It's kind of funny, actually, because some super common things I have very few pictures of, and they aren't very good pictures, and they're ones I took a long time ago.
Yeah.
When I just was first learning, and I was like, oh, I need to take a picture of that. But I see them all the time. I learn to recognize them. So now I just kind of enjoy them on different terms and
mm-hmm.
don't even think about taking pictures. And then I go, and somebody's like, oh, do you have a picture of this? I'm like, I must. They're super common.
Yeah.
And I look, I'm like, I have one picture, and it's
yeah.
a bad one. I'm like, oh,
right.
I better take some pictures of this. But
yeah, it's the same thing. It's like when you first hop in the water, everybody takes pictures of, oh, look at all this beautiful macrocystis kelp. And later on, you're like, yeah, it's kelp. Like, it's everywhere. Like,
yeah.
it's not something fun to take photos of. But yeah, it is really interesting how that works out and how that happens. But
yeah, well, so what you said you like the line drawings for especially working with kids, and I suppose, you know, as you get more experience, you learn that it isn't like structure of the patterns, you know, mm-hmm. not the colors. Because things will vary, like eelgrass versus kelp, you know.
Yeah.
Being bright green on kelp is not such an advantage, whereas right. being on... And so it could be the same species, just in a different...
Yeah.
I guess they call those ecotypes, I
right.
suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at structures or color patterns as opposed to the actual colors
mm-hmm.
Become important. And once you've done that, then I suppose it's easier to interpret the color photos in a way.
Definitely. And I think part of it, too, is, again, like that difference between looking at the critter when it's out of the water mm-hmm. at low tide and then when it's in the water. I mean, even, you know, nudibranchs are one of my favorites, but out of the water, they're just like all scrunched up and just look kind of like a blob. But when you see them in the water, they actually have these antenna looking things are called rhinophores. And some of them have like fluffy gill plumes on their back. And some of them have bumps and long dangly appendages. And you just don't get to see those things out of the water. And so, again, it's kind of also taking into account your environment. And I really think when you hop in the water is when you get to see all of those really intricate details for a lot of these critters, because they're invertebrates. And so their body doesn't necessarily hold shape very well out of the water.
Well, and that's one of the things that was interesting. I spoke with Aaron Baldwin's been a guest on the show before, and he was telling me that, you know, a lot of the keys for some groups, they're based on museum collections, which have been in formaldehyde or whatever for ages. So all the color is gone, mm-hmm. and, you know, there's just whatever, like, sort of, and many cases, shall we say, esoteric structures, you know, the subtle. And the keys are based on those. And he said, but if you actually have a live specimen in hand, the two things, like in the key, may be difficult,
mm-hmm.
are obviously different.
Yeah.
But it's because the characteristics that you have access to in a collection are different than those in real life. And I imagine, you know, that's one of the things that as birding has become more popular over the last 100 and however many years,
mm-hmm.
People started paying attention to more, not just like originally birding ornithology was like shoot, identify,
right.
you know, measure, identify in the lab, essentially. And that, you know, there's no life there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I imagine it's similar, you know, for these invertebrates that it's just now where, I mean, obviously it's a smaller niche of people that are really interested, but still a very passionate niche of people that the internet allows them and us to communicate more effectively in ways that we can start to understand things, not just in the collection vial sort of sense,
mm-hmm.
but like, oh, we can learn to recognize and then understand like the ecology of them and the whole natural history of them, which to me is really fascinating. I mean, that's the reason for the name isn't to just end there, but rather to have a, you know, have a cubby in the drawer file system, you know, where you can
attach all those details you're learning as you go and experiences. Yeah, and I would say in marine science, it's even more extreme than some terrestrial science in that, you know, it's just in the last several decades that we've really gained huge leaps and bounds in the technology that allows us to go into this environment mm-hmm. and really see the things where they live. You know, I mean, wetsuits alone have come leaps and bounds in my lifetime, and just now you can get lighter, more movable pieces that are going to keep you warmer longer. You know, scuba gear is now a common thing that people can get pretty easy. Even, you know, working at the Science Center, Tori O'Connell spent time in submarines, and that's something that before we developed submarines and used them for research purposes, we really had no idea what was down there. And there's so much cutting edge research going on in marine science right now because of these technological advances that have really come around in the last several decades.
I suppose just even in the last just handful of years, the ability to attach your GoPro to your fishing line, essentially, and I've seen these, I guess they just put them on their lead weight or something and like the halibut or the salmon come up and
mm-hmm.
like it's actually pretty interesting.
GoPro is totally revolutionizing marine footage in
mm-hmm.
general. I mean, anyone can go now, and it's a great, really easy underwater housing to work with. That's the problem with a lot of underwater housing is pretty much any camera that you own, you can buy an underwater housing, but most of the time it's as expensive, if not more, than the camera itself. And then you're always constantly afraid of it leaking and ruining your camera and all of those things. And so it can be really tricky, whereas GoPro now is fairly inexpensive.
Yeah, so for a couple $100 you can get a GoPro setup with the underwater housing.
Exactly, and it takes amazing footage, and you can just go with it. It's tiny, really compact. You know, they have all those wonderful straps for it. We've used it. My first year doing salmon research here in Southeast, we took a ton of footage in the stream of fish, and it was amazing to look at the footage. And we're standing right there above the water, you know, with our polarized lenses on, even looking into it. And when you get home, you just realize that there were 10 times as many fish there than you could even see. It was really amazing.
So, yeah, so that I wanted to ask you about your, that's part of the chum research stuff. And I just, like, this summer there was a vagrant sockeye in Indian River. And I was like, oh, that's, I mean, it was bright red. And so I was like, oh, that's cool. So, and I bought a GoPro. And so I just anchored it down. Like, there was a submerged, it was a waterlogged hunk of wood, basically. It wasn't going anywhere. And I just clipped it to that and just set it up where the salmon was liking to go. And then I walked away and I just let it run for like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was for, like I skipped ahead and stuff. But there was like these, it almost reminded me of Star Wars, you know, like the opening of Star Wars where the big destroyer comes just right across. It was like that, except it was this sockeye salmon. It was just right, it came right across the front and you just like this. You need big Star Wars music to go
super
with it, but
zoomed in.
It was kind of, it was cool. It was fun. It was so easy to just do that and let it go. I mean, it was I didn't know what I was going to get. It took a little time at home, but and I think I'd seen some footage, maybe of one of the. So this is the CHUM program that the Science Center's been, I guess, working with. It's from a different organization, sort of holds the big project.
But. Yeah, so it's a project that Fish and Game and several other organizations have created a science panel that leads the study. But then the contract for the work is through Prince William Sound Science Center, and they just happen to subcontract us here in Sitka to do the southeast part of it because they're doing part of the study up there in Prince William Sound and the other part down here. So this was our third full field season of work on this CHUM project. And really what it's looking at is it's trying to get to the bare bones of how are hatchery and wild fish interacting in streams. And the idea behind this, of course, is that we raise a lot of hatchery fish here. And there's always this question of, is there an impact on the wild fish, either positive or negative, based on those hatchery fish? And so, like you said, there's stray happening. I mean, you saw a sockeye go up Indian River this year, and that's natural. The fish have to stray in order to preserve genetic diversity. There has to be a little bit amount of stray that happens every year, fish that don't go back to their natal stream, even though we're taught year after year the salmon go back to their natal stream. Most of them do. But there is a little bit of stray. And so, of course, some hatchery fish also stray. And so that's what this study is really looking at. It's 32 streams all over Southeast Alaska, and we're trying to get down to the question of where are the fish straying, in what amount are they straying, and does it matter ultimately that they're straying?
Yeah. So I'm curious, like, you know, the Science Center hatchery, very small in terms of production standard, you know, by commercial or like large hatchery production or Southeast hatcheries. I mean, it's really very small. It was set up as an educational one just to get people, but it, you know, the water is diverted from Indian River and I imagine there's an immense amount of strain, you know, between like fish that hatch in or you know, originate in Indian River end up at the hatchery and vice versa. But so, like further away, say South Baranoff, I wouldn't really expect there to be SJ or Sitka the Science Center fish there necessarily. Mm-hmm. Whereas maybe Armstrong Keta,
right?
And so, like, is there a sense of, is that one of the questions that's being looked at?
Yeah.
Is like, is there a spatial relationship between strays and the hatchery of origin?
Yeah, that's one part of it, and that's what we're. Why there's so many streams all over Southeast, and they're sort of different distances from hatcheries that exist. And so, yeah, we're looking at, you know, how many fish are hatchery fish, and then where did they come from? And is there that relationship spatially? Actually, the project is looking at lots of different components.
Yeah.
It's really remarkable, all the things they're trying to look at.
But. So as a practical matter, you go out and you splash around in some streams, so you know the fish are back. And so hatcheries are required to do otoliths marking.
Mm-hmm.
Do they also tag the fish?
So it depends on the species. So all of the chum and pink salmon in Alaska are otolith marked.
Okay.
And then the coho and the chinook are coated wire tag marked.
Okay.
And so, and it's not all of them because the coated wire tagging is a little bit more intensive. There's a certain percentage that all a hatchery has to mark. But every chum salmon is marked with an otolith mark.
And so that just is, the otolith is a ear bone, essentially, and it layers as the fish grows. And so by varying the water temperature, essentially, you can create rings, more or less.
Yeah.
And then some brave soul gets to look at the ear bone and count rings, or the spacing of rings, or however, to identify where it came from.
Yeah, it's really cool. The whole process of marking them happens while they're still in the egg. They haven't hatched yet.
Oh, and so, that young.
Yeah, they're teeny tiny. They're in the incubator when we do it. And so that's the great thing is you can just raise the water temperature for 12 hours and do all your whole lot of salmon at the same time. The mark is actually really teeny tiny on their ear bone because their ear bones, of course, were so small at that point. So I've been going around streams and collecting ear bones from these adult fish that have spawned, and then we just collect them all and send them off to the lab. And yes, some poor soul sits in the lab and grinds down the ear bone to the point where they can see that little mark that we put on those fish when they were still eggs.
So, and you sort of glossed over the collect the ear bone part of that from fish that are spawned. And my experience with spawned out salmon is that they are gross. They're rather smelly and slimy. And so that's part of this adventure that is splashing around in remote streams. Maybe there are bears.
Yeah.
And digging out. So, like, you essentially, like, you have to pull the head apart, essentially, to get in to where the ear bone is.
So, I was lucky my first 2 years of the project in that I was doing part of the pedigree work. So, we needed, like, viable genetic tissue off of the fish. So, we got to collect fish that either had just spawned and hadn't quite died yet or had, like, just recently died. So, those 2 years, I counted myself lucky that I got to handle such wonderful fish. This last year, though, I did otolith-only streams. And so that means we will collect any head that you can still identify as a chum, which is remarkable how little evidence you have in order to tell that it's a chum salmon. You're just collecting the dead chums, and you're basically cutting the top of the head off. The otoliths are right below the brain, and so you need to just open the brain cavity, and then, you grab them out with your tweezers and clean them off a little bit and put them in your sample containers. So
you guys were collecting anything that you could get, pretty much.
Yeah, right? I mean, there were some days where as you're holding the carcass of this fish, it's falling apart. And the only thing you wind up with when you get to your sample site is like the skull cap. It's like not even there's no lower jaw, there's no body left. It's not even the eye socket. It's just like the skull cap where the brain is. And you have a handful of them. And you knew that it was a chum salmon when you picked it up. That's the only way that you can still sample it because you were sure at that point.
So you essentially, presumably multiple of you, like partners or whatever, for safety, if nothing else, because I imagine that it's not infrequent to run into bears.
Right.
Or for them to be around in any case. And then so you're just basically gathering up these bodies, and then you're taking it back to a site where I guess you have the tools to cut open.
So we actually do most of the sampling in the stream.
Oh, okay.
But rather than stop every time we get a fish and get all the gear out, we usually try to gather the fish for, a small chunk of the stream into one kind of processing area is what we call them.
Yeah.
And so, we hike. There's usually three people on a crew. And then we also have a bear guide that goes with us because there are bears and it's quite common to run into them. And it depends on the year whether you have issues or not. But we were really lucky this year. We had no problem bears, which is always wonderful. So you hike the stream usually either from top to bottom or bottom to top. And as you go, you stop and sample fish. And so when possible, we're also trying to record the sex of the fish and the length of the fish and the height of the fish, as well as take the otoliths out of them.
Yeah.
And then because we're stopping along the stream, you also can look at their spatial distribution in the stream. So is there a difference? Do hatchery fish all spawn at the bottom of the stream where the wild fish go all the way to the top?
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
you know, is there a separation there or is there a timing separation? Yeah. We make several visits to the stream throughout the run.
Yeah.
And so that's another part of the project that they can look at is, you know, did all the hatchery fish come early and the wild fish were much later in the season? Or what are those differences, if there are any?
So you're getting like thousands of otoliths then.
Yeah. So on every stream, our minimum collection is 384 otoliths. And so some streams, we aren't able to get those because maybe there's a smaller run or we didn't hit the timing right or something like that. And other streams will collect in excess to get kind of that spatial and temporal difference.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there were a few streams where we collected 800 otoliths, you know, and then they'll subsample those. They'll take a few from each visit. And
I see.
They thankfully won't read all all 800 of them.
Right. No, that yeah, I was thinking that the, like, as intensive as it is to spend the summer in the field, like, the grind of actually paying somebody to sit there and grind and read those would be probably fairly expensive also. And yeah, so it's interesting to kind of, so I guess if I happen to be wandering around on a stream and find this mysterious pile of fish heads with the heads cut off, or with the top of the head cut off, I guess then I'll know I've run into a site where you guys were working.
Yeah, we were all over Southeast. And there are some, I mean, we have one on Douglas Island in Juneau. And so there are people there all the time fishing and hiking. And it's really funny sometimes the comments you get and the looks that people give you. And, you know, we always try to be really good about explaining, like, oh, we're here to do this study and we're looking at this, and otherwise it can be a little bit strange for folks.
Yeah, I'd have been sorely tempted to make up a story about, you know, some sort of religious rite or whatever, you know, like, I worship the salmon and this is how I do it.
Yeah.
No, before I would then explain the real story, I guess, but yeah.
Well, and we have a lot of time in the field with just a small group of people, so you would be amazed the stories that we come up with that we joke about. We don't usually tell them to people.
Don't share those to the public. I imagine you get a little... things get interesting in the field after an extent. So you're spending like a month. Is it kind of a fairly intensive month out sampling, or is it even longer?
It's 6 weeks, and we live on a boat while we travel around, and then we come to port every 10 to 14 days usually.
Yeah.
So it gets really interesting when it's three of you plus a bear guide, and then we usually have a cook on the boat and maybe another captain or bear guide or something. So there's six of you who live and work together every day for 6 weeks. So usually about the first week, you're kind of getting to know each other and everyone's a little hesitant. The second week, you really start to open up a little bit. By the end, you almost speak entirely in inside jokes and like weird noises that somehow you understand one another. It gets really strange, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it seems like it could be. Well, with the wrong crew, it could probably be unfun, but
that's true.
With the right crew of people, it could be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And so you're actually going back to the boat every day then?
Yeah.
And so
each day we're on a larger boat, usually 50 feet or so. Mm-hmm. And that's the boat we take to drive to the next stream. And so then in the morning, we'll hop in a skiff, drive to shore, hike the stream and sample, come back that evening and go to the large boat, and then the large boat will fire up and take us to the next stream for the next
day. So you'll just spend one day at a time at each stream.
Yep.
And you're able to – so you weren't – so this wasn't something like where you're going 7 miles up the river to –
There are some days where you do. It's I have had some streams this year where we would do like 13 miles round trip. And so it gets to be a lot. 13 miles doesn't necessarily seem like a lot when you think about just hiking.
No, but without a trail.
Yeah, you're up and down. So you're in the water a lot of the time, walking against the water, and then over log jams and
right,
things like
that's what I mean. But, like, walking a stream without a trail, like even if you just imagined walking up Indian River without a trail, I'm trying to think as far as the fish go up, you know, I've seen fish up past the first bridge on Indian River Trail, definitely. Mm-hmm. Maybe not a huge distance past there in the case of pinks and chumps, but you know, like if you could imagine, because there's places where you couldn't wade, you'd have to climb out and go around.
Yep.
You know, bedrock cascades and things like that. And so
swift water that you have to figure out your way
and
to navigate through.
And then on the sides, it's really brushy. And then there's the deadfalls and stuff that are inconvenient to navigate.
It's always interesting, for sure. You really beat yourself up pretty hard in the beginning because, of course, it's like nothing else. You're not used to it. Every year, this is my third year doing it, and every year I go into it and I'm not prepared. You know, your body's just not used to that. And so our average stream is about 3 miles each way. Mm-hmm. And then we had those longer ones, and we had some that were shorter. We had some that were under a mile each direction. So it just kind of depends.
Yeah. And are you trying to get up to as far as the fish are going?
Yep.
And basically is the idea?
So that's the goal. And a lot of times there's just no way to say how far the fish go. Sometimes there's a big waterfall, and it's really obvious.
Right.
Like, this is all the further the chum can go. So then we can turn around. A lot of times the habitat kind of gets poor, and the fish kind of start to become less common, and so you can't find as many chum. But then we still hike for a little bit longer, hopefully, as long as we have enough time and are going to be able to get our samples. And so that's really the thing, is trying to find where is that turnaround point, how far do you have to sample.
I'm curious, as we're kind of getting towards the end here, what are some of the is there any particular sort of experience? I mean, so it sounds like you went over, I don't know if you sampled the full range of all 32 in Southeast, but you got some places that, you know, the nature of sampling being what it is, often it would take you places you would never, like, think about going otherwise, because, like, who would go there? But then it's not unusual sometimes for those places to be actually pretty inspiring and be like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious if you have any kind of experiences, like, there's no way on earth that you would have ever gone to some of these places, but yet having gone there, you're like, those were pretty awesome.
Yeah. I think there are lots of those. It's hard to pick ones. With Southeast being the way that it is, there are so many remote locations that you might not get to otherwise. I think the one that stands out the most is, like, I would never, especially by myself, go there, is Ralph's Creek. It's kind of on northeast Baranof. And Ralph's Creek has kind of a short intertidal zone, and probably about a half mile upstream, it becomes this very steep gorge.
Okay. What drainage is this in?
Oh, I don't even know which drainage it is.
Or bay. Do you remember the bay?
Mm-mm.
So I've Ralph's Creek doesn't sound like an official name, maybe. But
yeah, that's the trick always. Is it's pretty far. It's above all the hatcheries on.
Yeah,
on
so it's above
Eastern
Hidden Falls.
Yeah.
But is it south of, like, Peril Strait?
Yes.
So it's there's not a lot of options there,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it's pretty sparse area up there.
Yeah.
But it would be interesting to look and see if that is the official name or not. But a lot of them don't have official names.
Right, yeah.
It's just really unique in that about a half mile up, it becomes this gorge, and the gorge is probably a quarter mile long, and the bears, of course, concentrate there because that's a pinch point for the fish that have to go through, and it's also hard for them to get in and out. So I'd say that it was mildly stressful at times being in a gorge with, you know, anywhere from 2 to 7 bears at any time, and they can't get out of the gorge, and you can't get out of the gorge. And so you're just kind of doing this little dance of how do we get upstream to go sample fish while still staying out of their way.
So were you guys going up beyond that? Were the fish able to go beyond
that? Oh, yeah.
That?
We had to go another, like, mile and a half past that. So every time we went, you had to go up through the gorge and back down through the gorge.
I see.
So it was... it was beautiful and amazing, and we got to do some really wonderful bear watching. But that's always mildly stressful to be there and, you know, be in their zone where they're fishing. And it's loud in a stream, and especially in a gorge. So often they can't hear you, even though you might be yelling at them, so they know that you're there. And that's what you always want to eliminate, is startling a bear and sneaking up on one. So that's always the goal, is to...
So are they pretty... I mean, like, what I'm imagining here is like, limited access, so probably very well-worn trails if it's this popular of a place, like, for bears, which aren't necessarily the best trails for people, given the differences in structure. But
it's actually interesting in that the bears usually just go up the river there, up the stream. So they're much heavier, of course, and don't get swept away as easily as people do, and are much more adapted to walking around in the stream with four legs and all of those types of things. So they actually just wander up the stream and hop in the giant pools and just, you know, roll around in them and those sorts of things. Whereas we're constantly like trying to find, how do we cross over to the other side here because we can walk on that edge. And then when the bears leave, they just go straight up this gorge. And they have a few paths where it's easier that they use to access it, but it's something that we would never try to take. It's not really fun. But yeah, there are definitely favorite spots though, and you can tell like this is the bear's favorite spot, and that's definitely where we want to go across too. So
yeah, no, that'd be interesting. To it sounds like an interesting place to visit. And I guess one last question that I have that sort of tying back a couple of our subjects is: did you try any snorkeling in the rivers, like snorkeling with the fish?
Or? I haven't yet. It's always been one of my goals to hop in and do
get
snorkel
one of those
surveys
deep and pools. And
yeah, it would just be amazing. One of my crew members this year had done snorkel surveys in Idaho, so it was a constant topic of discussion all season. Was we used to hop in this, you know, he'd be like, we used to hop in the creek and snorkel, and they would go through like 6 inches of water, so you're basically crawling with snorkel gear on and trying to survey. But that's one thing I would love to try to do at some point.
Yeah, I've seen, like, and I guess, you know, I think it was the videos that I saw, maybe one of the crew folks for that project had posted. Was it dollies grabbing fish eggs or something as they were washing down the stream?
Yep.
It's
so cool.
I think that was GoPro. You know, must have been just anchor it down.
That was our first season. We had attached the GoPro to the bottom of like a pole that we use for collecting carcasses and put it in there. And you have eggs that you're coming across from time to time. Bears will, you know, start on a carcass and you come to some eggs. And so we would grab them and we would find them and toss them in. And you could just watch the dollies come out of little tiny holes and come grab all the eggs. And otherwise, they're so well camouflaged, you hardly notice how many dollies are in the stream. But there are a lot of them there. And I imagine snorkeling, you would get to see so much more of that.
Yeah, every once in a while, like, I think of a couple of pools, or one pool in particular along Indian River Trail, where, like, the silver salmon like to pool up in there a lot. Mm-hmm. And but there's often, if you look, there's at least a few dollies, you know, at the margins, and they're so much smaller but they are hard to see. I mean, they blend into the, just sort of the, I imagine they're a lot easier to see, you know, from a profile side shot in the water, but I imagine they're hiding too. Although the salmon wouldn't be trying to eat them, but other birds or something maybe.
Yeah, I think mostly birds. A lot of their predators come from the top, I think. And that's the whole reason the dollies are in the stream that time of year, is they're waiting for the salmon to spawn, and then they sneak a few eggs before they settle into the gravel. So
yeah, no, that makes sense. And the whole life of, I mean, this is, you probably don't know the answers to all these questions. I'm just going to ask them because they're on my mind at the moment. But Dolly Varden, like, I know Dolly Varden, winter in lakes, their winter survival is much higher in lakes. Maybe apparently they can winter in a stream, but they're moving in and out of salt water regularly.
Yeah.
And so, like, the physiology required to do that, I mean, that's one of those things that, because we don't care, we don't really think about the, I guess it's osmotic pressure and all those other things, that it's not an easy transition to go between salt and fresh water. But these dollies are going up into the streams, getting salmon eggs out in the salt water, going up into lakes in the winter, coming back out again. And
yeah, I have no idea how they're able to do it. It's so amazing. I mean, the idea, I mean, when salmon do it, it's like changes in their kidneys, you know, changes in how they regulate. I mean, living in freshwater, you're constantly trying to pump water out of you. You know, you don't want to, it's like if you stuck a raisin in water, it would puff up, right? So you don't want that to happen. So that's your whole goal, is to pump all that water out. But then when you go in saltwater, it's exactly the opposite. The water is being constantly sucked out of you, and you want to keep all of the water in your body. And with water being so crucial to everything that our bodies do, no matter what living thing we're talking about, it's amazing that they can go back and forth and do both of those things several times throughout their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the mysteries, I guess. There's lots of them. So, I guess just as we close here, is anything that you'd recommend folks checking out at the Science Center in the near future?
Oh, well, I guess I would just say that in the wintertime, it's a lot quieter at the Science Center. So if you're the type who likes to come and explore and just spend a lot of time looking and you're not able to go snorkeling, which of course I would suggest that first, you should definitely come down to the Science Center and just hang out for a while because it's so much quieter. You're not interrupted by lots of other visitors and things like that often. And of course, tank feeding is always exciting. Everybody likes to come. It's 2 o'clock on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. So most of the critters come out then and get really lively. And so it's a great time to come and see everybody.
All right. And so, and you mentioned there's a docent program for adults. Is that something that's ongoing now or that you're going to start up again soon? Or
so we'll start a new round of docent training in the spring. Okay. So if you're interested in getting involved with that, you can always call me or email me and I'll put your name on a list to let you know when it starts. It usually starts towards the end of February every year.
Okay.
And then we'll train a new group. And then after you've gone through the training, you can come in throughout the year and help out with lots of different things.
All right, great. Well, thanks for coming in and visiting.
Definitely. Thanks for having me. It was great.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with Ashley Bulwark, the aquarium manager at the Science Center. She recently started that position after spending some years as the education specialist there. I want to thank her for taking some time out of her schedule to come and visit with me. And thanks to you for listening this week on the Sitka Nature Show. As always, you can find recordings of past shows at sitkanature.org/raven. Or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there, and you'll get updates when I post recordings of shows and some other things that I think might be of interest. You can also send me an email to sitkanature@gmail.com. I am very interested in hearing about what you're seeing out there. If you have questions or just things that you're interested in and want to share, feel free to send me an email with an attached photo or recording or just any questions that you might have. I'm happy to try and help you solve mysteries out there. And thanks for joining me this week. This has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show. Casey W. Sitka.